At Irregular Hours, episode 143 for December 22nd, 2020. I'm Steve Fodor.
I'm Little Tim Hessenflow, not to be confused with Tiny Tim.
And I'm Pam Bedore.
And we are here for another one of Charles Dickens's Christmas stories. This one, The Battle of Life, published in 1846. Very Victorian, this one, Pam.
Well, yes, and doesn't it sound exciting? The Battle of Life. This has got to be just like the other Victorian things we've read lately, with a lot of murder, potential serial killers, all kinds of action. That's pretty much what this was about, right?
Well, maybe-ish or not.
There's intrigue!
let me ask you. So this, I mean... Tell me, just give me your general impression, because this is a little bit, this is what, our third Charles Dickens Christmas story now. We've gone back to the 1840s. Did you guys like this story or not? Does it translate well to a 2020 audience? Is this something that we would recommend to people?
Let me start with the stinking thinking, because maybe Steve can save us. I did not enjoy this story.
You did not like it, Sam. I am.
Oh, I did not. I did not like it, and I tried. I was reading it. I was listening to it. I was reading and listening to it, and I just found it just not my cup of tea. And which is so sad, because Dickens is so well known. I can't get into the groove of it. But I have a feeling that my friend Steve is going to save us here.
As usual. I liked this very much. You know me. I'm not one to say that I don't like things. I like everything. And I liked this very much. I think that Charles Dickens has given us a list of characters that are fun, interesting, well-fleshed out characters here. For me, that is the key to a good narrative, is I have to identify with these characters. I have to care about these characters. And this story did that very well. The story, okay, fine. There's no great beginning, middle, and end to this storytelling. This is not a Christmas Carol with a perfect narrative. But it's fun, it's interesting, and I find myself thinking of what the audience, and again, I'm thinking of a live narration, Charles Dickens up on stage orating this story, what a live audience would hear and experience in this interesting, fun evening of storytelling.
I like that. I like that approach. I think that I'm probably somewhere in between the two of you. And I actually read a really interesting article. I'm really fascinated with the double. And so I read an article by Goldie Morgenteller called The Doppelganger Effect, Dickens' Heredity and the Double in the Battle of Life. And here's how she opens her article. The Battle of Life is arguably one of the least successful of Dickens's fictions. Certainly, it is the weakest of the Christmas book. Its prose is overwrought, its plot is sentimental and attenuated, and it betrays the promise of its masterful opening paragraphs with an improbable plot. And she goes on to say something that we talked about last week when we were talking about Cricket and the Hearth. She goes on to say that sometimes when an author fails to produce a really gripping or compelling story, that's when you find out what they think about things. That's when you get to some of their themes. And this is something that we had talked about on the pod last week about how The Cricket in the Hearth doesn't translate well, but it still brings up some interesting ideas about early Victorian life and mores. So to me, that's what I take from this story, is like, what are the concerns? What are the questions that people were thinking about? We have to remember this is pre-Darwin, right? And so this is 1840s, and so we've spent so much time with Sherlock at the other end of the Victorian period, when people's epistemological concerns were so different. And so here, this idea about like, what would happen if two sisters were in love with the same man? Whew. I mean, Steve's compelled, maybe Chip and I aren't as much, but it's something that that people are thinking about. What is heredity? This is, she's very focused in this article on notions of heredity at this time, which I think like opens it up in interesting ways.
And I think there's some very interesting themes that he writes here. I think there's some very interesting philosophical questions that in this silly little story, we can hear the voice of Charles Dickens asking these questions. I love that opening. It begins, "Once upon a time, it matters little when, and in stalwart England, it matters little where, a fierce battle was fought." This idea of history, of time, of place is right there in that first sentence. And there's these other themes that we'll get to in the idea of this story.
Well, and I did think that opening was really, really strong as well. This notion of looking at a battlefield and with that now has huge fecundity, and the idea that when you fight a battle, that all of the dead bodies, the dead horses, he goes, he's got like a macabre sense to his prose, actually, you know, fertilize the ground and create these amazingly fertile plants and trees. And so that, of course, can be seen as sort of a metaphor more broadly for like, what you're willing to sacrifice. And this story is very much about sacrifice, which is a sort of Gift of the Magi Christmas theme. And so that does make sense. Now, there comes a moment where the doctor talks about the battle, and I found this fascinating. He says, "Yet not 100 people in that battle knew for what they fought or why. Not 100 of the inconsiderable rejoicers in the victory, why they rejoiced. Not 50 people were the better for the gain or loss. Not 6 men agree to this hour on the cause or merits, and nobody, in short, ever knew anything distinct about it, but the mourners of the slain." That's like a Dickensian critique, right? Like, we send people to war who don't even know what they're fighting for, and honestly, do the citizens know? Who really even knows what battles are about? How do we convince all these people to sacrifice their lives for a battle whose goals are not even well understood or communicated?
That's a fascinating point right there that you made. So once again, if we had to say a theme of Dickens, a lot of Dickens' work, is he's certainly addressing the common man, the everyday, as a common person, the everyday person. This is not the king who may have a grudge somewhere and decides they're going to have a battle. These are the people who are just basically pulled from the land or the village or wherever it is, and they're told, "All right, here's your uniform. Let's go have a battle." They have no choice on that. This is the everyday fight. I mean, and when Dickens says something to the effect like, "Well, we didn't even know why we were fighting." Of course you don't. You're not part of the discussion. Those discussions are made in a different place with a different group of people. You're just not part of.
Right. And it brings you to that very Marxist notion of humans as cogs, which is something that Dickens comes back to again and again. Not so much in the Christmas stories, but you just get a hint in his larger, more famous novels like David Copperfield, Oliver Twist, Pickwick Papers. That's one of his themes, is this really proto-Marxist analysis of human beings treated as cogs in a political machine. And you get a little taste of it right here with the doctor's philosophy.
But the real overwhelming theme about this setting and this battle is about renewal. It's about the history that goes on after this battle. The battle is forgotten, with the exception of when it's brought up again later in the story as a counterpoint to what's happening and as a metaphor for the battle of life. I like this story very much.
Well, thank goodness. At least one of us does.
I like this storytelling here. This is good, fun. I can envision all of these things happening. Maybe I just had the right narrator for my audiobook that I was listening to. Maybe I had just the right moment in my day to listen to this. Maybe it was a state of mind for me. But It was a pleasant, lively, natural scene, a beautiful day, a retired spot, and the two girls, quite unconstrained and careless, danced in the very freedom and gaiety of their hearts. I had this vision of these girls absolutely enthralled in joy, dancing to their heart's content, literally, because it was one of their birthdays. I love this vision of the story.
And they're dancing on the battlefield, mm-hmm. where humans have been killed and under which humans are buried. And so that's a big part of it, is that, like, that idea that we have so little sense of history, right? So that when we go about living our lives, we don't always think about who died for us to be here. So there's, like, a dark side mm-hmm. to that lively storytelling, which Dickens is 100% putting on display.
Mm-hmm. And we get to the birthday. We get to the joy of annual celebration. Isn't that what we're at with Christmas? This joy, this community, this coming together, this annual tradition is on display for this birthday. I love this quote. I love this quote. The daughters are dancing with this absolute joy, and the father comes up. And the daughter says, "Make some allowance for it, father, if it be," replied his younger daughter, Marion, going close to him. And looking into his face, she says, "For it's somebody's birthday." And he replies, "Somebody's birthday? Don't you know it's always somebody's birthday? Did you never hear how many new performers enter on this? It's impossible to speak gravely of it. On this preposterous and ridiculous business called life, every minute, there's always, it's always somebody's birthday, but it's Marion's birthday. She's celebrating her existence and coming up to her father, and he's toying with her idea of, oh, I'm not going to celebrate you today. Of course he is. He's going to spoil the heck out of her.
What a great thought for the holiday season. Obviously, with COVID here, many people are struggling to figure out what their holiday experiences are going to be like. And, you know, Christmas trees, many of them were sold early this year. And part of it was this idea of trying to create some normalcy and some tradition and to capture something when, you know, maybe there's not a lot going on outside this. And so I understand why this is, you know, such an important part of this type of story. Is I do. I think traditions really matter, and they are just important to how we view ourselves in life.
Of all days in this foolish year, why on this day the great battle was fought on this ground? He's really messing with her. Like, oh, it's your birthday, but this was the celebration of this battle on this ground. Of all days in this foolish year. Talk about foolish years. My goodness, 2020 was a foolish year.
But Steve, I think there's more than just teasing going on there. There's a lot of foreshadowing too, right? Because the battle is about sacrifice. And our friend Marion is all about the sacrifice.
Mm-hmm. This is such a Shakespearean setting, this pastoral tale, these young ladies out dancing, finding joy. There's traveling minstrels, for God's sake. They hired musicians that were traveling minstrels to come and play music for them to dance. This is very Shakespearean, more than anything that we've read from Dickens up until this point.
So I make this statement like, oh, this is for the common man. At the same time, how many of the common people or common humans could hire traveling minstrels and stuff like that to come by and perform? I mean,
I think it's
a contradiction.
I don't know, Chip. I mean, we listen to the radio.
Yeah,
we have those musicians in our lives.
They're on the street corner and stuff like that. Maybe in Victorian time.
Yeah, you know, this is pre-radio, pre-television. The entertainers of the day would be traveling around and wanting to play music for you. So we get into the larger metaphor, the battle of life. And the characters talk about the farce. And they talk about it, not the force, the farce, which is
The farce is with you, Steve.
And also with you. The idea of life as a ridiculous mystery, the ridiculousness of this thing called life is one of the great conversations in this.
And that's something that specifically resides with the doctor. He's the one who's constantly saying life is just a farce, like the stage. We all are on the stage all the time. And so stories are taken right out of real life.
How Shakespearean is that? The stage, and we are all merely players. Interesting.
For a period of time. Your time is short, right? Hmm.
I don't know why you don't like this. I like this very much.
And it has that wonderful Victorian theme of orphans. And we do, of course, see orphans as very common characters in young adult literature. And this kind of has a little bit of a YA feel to it, I think. In a way. I mean, it's...
I think you're right.
Not entirely, but a little bit.
I love YA literature. Speaking as somebody who talks to YAs all day long, I love YA literature. I love the perspective of a 12-year-old, a 14-year-old, up to maybe even a 20-year-old. That idea of I have the future in front of me, and the theme of orphan being my past might be holding me back, but then again, I might be able to rise past it.
All right, so for those who are not familiar with the term YA, who wants to define it for us?
Young adult. Young adult literature is one of my favorite types of writing because I think like a young adult most of my day. I watch a lot of Muppets. I watch a lot of Star Wars. And I talk to my 12 to 14-year-old kids in school all day. And I really identify that type of literature as one of my favorites.
And you're correct. And not that I'm the authority on this, but I think this is meant for a general audience. It's meant for everybody. It's meant from grandma and from the children, everybody in between.
And now, one of the other common tropes of young adult literature is forging those really, really close connections. And here we see the connection between the sisters. So, and that connection, just like the fecundity of the earth comes from the battle, that connection comes from the loss of the mother, right? So here's a quotation. The difference between them and respective age could not exceed 4 years at most. But Grace, as often happens in such cases, when no mother watches over both, the doctor's wife was dead, seemed in her gentle care of her younger sister and in the steadiness of her devotion to her, older than she was, and more removed in course of nature from all competition with her or participation, otherwise than through her sympathy and true affection in her wayward fancies than their ages seemed to warrant. Great character of mother, that even in this shadow and faint reflection of it purifies the heart and raises the exalted nature nearer to the angels. Exclamation point. So I have to say, as I was reading that, I was thinking, yeah, Dickens really does use those long Victorian sentences. That first sentence was like 100 words. But anyway, but what he's saying here is that because of their orphan status, their mother is dead, they actually are super, super close to one another. And the older sister has taken on a mothering role. And so she's not in competition with her little sister in the way that we often do see sibling rivalry with kids who are 4 years, whose age gap is 4 years or less. But there's a place where our narrator is a little bit incorrect. So Grace doesn't want to be in a sibling rivalry with her sister, but of course they are both interested in the same man. And so, so of course, Alfred, who, by the way, I'm sorry, Steve, you said like the characters are so deep and wonderful. I'm like,
Alfred.
Alfred's just a pawn on the chessboard as far as I can see. He's desirable man, Alfred. But whatever.
You're right. You're right. Alfred is a non-character character here, yes.
You will be playing desirable man Alfred.
Yeah.
Exactly.
What does that mean? Here, we're just gonna just pretend like you're cardboard and we'll put you right there.
Yeah.
You guys know that I'm not a big fan of biographical readings, but I still love to bring them up. And I know that, Steve, you like bio readings way more than I do. So I learned in this article that I read, The Doppelganger Effect, that Dickens really struggled to write this, his least successful Christmas story. He was writing it at the same time as he was writing Dombey and Sons, which is a big, big novel. And he actually almost suffered a nervous collapse through overwork. And of course, he had to get it done by Christmas. He started it in September and he really struggled to get it done. Now, my critic here, Goldie Morgenthaler, she makes the argument that there might be a biographical element with the sisters. And she said that Dickens's wife, her sisters lived with them, and Dickens was super close to her two younger sisters. And so at first her younger sister, Mary, lived with them and she died. And Dickens was like devastated. And then her other younger sister, Georgina, moved in with them and he was very close to her as well. And so she sees this as a bit like Marion and Mary, Grace and Georgina, as referring to, and then also that total like logic of substitution. So, you know, if the younger sister sacrifices herself by mysteriously disappearing, then the older sister will just naturally take the desirable man number one, right? Like that's so again.
Well.
And it's interesting how the suitors are kind of set up as well. And these are, I'm not saying, okay, I don't think Alfred is a great character, but that logic of substitution, the double, it is a fascinating element of Victorian literature. And, you know, the only thing that would have made it better is if these two were twins. But, you know, so it's interesting when we get first introduced to the two potential suitors. And when we are first introduced, these two suitors are both interested in Marion, right? We have Alfred and then Michael Warden. So this is, I love the lawyers, Snitchy and Craggs. So he, Mr. Alfred, her old playfellow too. You remember Mr. Craggs, said Snitchy with a disconcerting laugh. Knew her almost from a baby. Which makes it the more probable that she may be tired of his idea, calmly pursued the client. Client being desirable man number two. And not indisposed to exchange it for the newer one of another lover who presents himself or is presented by his horse under romantic circumstances, has the not unfavorable reputation with the country girl of having lived thoughtlessly and gaily without doing much harm to anybody, and who, for his youth and figure, and so forth, this may seem foppish again, but upon my soul I don't mean it in that light, might perhaps pass muster in a crowd with Mr. Alfred himself. So here we get, oh my gosh, another 100-word sentence, but here we get Michael Warden saying, you know, Alfred knew her from the time she was a baby, which again, just as in the cricket in the hearth, maybe doesn't translate to 2020, like meeting your future spouse in her childhood doesn't sound that fantastic to us. But here's a guy who's lived a bit more of a bad boy, and Mary might be interested in both of them. But of course, so now we have these two triangles, right? We got two boys interested in Marion. We got Marion and Grace interested in Alfred. So, mm-hmm. I mean, I guess it's fascinating what happens next, but it's also somewhat predictable that mm-hmm. you have four eligible people. Their desires are misaligned, but in a comedic fashion, you can align all those desires and everybody can be happy in the end.
It couldn't be any more Shakespearean. That is the narrative of all the Shakespeare comedies, is love triangles and misunderstandings and finding true love at the end. This is Shakespearean.
I'm wondering, because we've said it twice, there's very long sentences here. Mm-hmm. I'm wondering if that is one of my challenges to enjoying this writing. Maybe it's the long sentences. Dickens didn't have Grammarly to help. I get it.
I love the aside. He who presents himself, parentheses, or is presented by his horse. That is so funny. We get these great, funny, comic characters here. Snitchy and Craig's are just hilarious. I love how you almost did the voice of Snitchy when you were reading that. Because he's a character. I love how Dickens puts these two characters together. They are absolutely tied together. That back to that idea of the doppelganger. These two people are one person presented together, mostly by Snitchy.
And it's interesting because the way the double works, right, and in Victorian fiction, but still today, whenever you have those two characters who are so similar to each other, it can work as the logic of substitution I was talking about. Right, where we have these two sisters, they're very similar to one another, and oh, guess what? You could substitute one for the other, you wouldn't even notice. You thought you were going to marry one, marry the other, you're just as happy. Or it can work as part of the divided self. That notion, like in fiction, we create these two characters, but really they're just two halves of a person, two halves of yourself. They're like that acknowledgement that you have different sides of yourself. And Snitchy and Craig's are obviously divided self doubles, right? Like, after Craig's dies, Snitchy just keeps talking about him. And he then refers to himself as Self. Self and Craig's.
Mm-hmm. And doesn't take his name off of the business, just like Scrooge never took Marley's name off of the business. I love that all of the interchanges and all the running gags. There are running gags in this story. Snitchy thinks everything is too easy these days, and he says that 7 times in this very short story. Craig's thinks that the world has gone to law. Everything's about the law. He says that 5 times in this story, even though he dies halfway through. I love the running gags. I love the interaction between these two characters.
And their wives are just as interchangeable as they are.
Yes! Oh my God. I love this! The wives...
Thank you, Steve.
The wives just... They are so silly characters. They had each other, Snitchy and Craig. I'm going to read this. Snitchy and Craig's had each other in private life as in professional existence, a partner of his own. Snitchy and Craig's were the best friends in the world and had a real confidence in one another. But Mrs. Snitchy, by a dispensation not uncommon in the affairs of life, was, on principle, suspicious of Mr. Craig's, and Mrs. Craig's was on principle suspicious of Mr. Snitchy. "Your Snitchies, indeed," the latter lady would observe sometimes to Mrs. Craig's, using that imaginative plural, as if in disparagement of an objectionable pair of pantaloons. This is so fun! I don't know why you didn't love this, Chip.
Well, I think that maybe it would take a repeated reading for me. Because as you're reading it to me, you are certainly pointing out the whimsical nature of the writing. And as I am kind of getting through, I'm trying to get down the story and stuff like that. And it's just not, I'm not connecting with it. And I don't know why. Because you're showing there is a lot of playfulness in this writing. And I'm missing it.
And I mean, that is the case with writing of the earlier Victorian period. The sentences are really, really, really long. They're full of asides. There's lots of parentheticals, lots of M dashes all over the place. And the pacing is meant to be very slow. And so, Chip, you and I are thinking, what is anything going to happen in this story? Like, what's happening?
And I can't disagree with that. It is, you know, not, I mean, the narrative, it's the characters for me.
And, okay. Well, I mean, that's all there is. Like, you can't, no one's going to be like, this plot is outstanding. Like, if you were going to tell someone the story, you'd be like, oh my goodness, so here's what happens. There's these two sisters that are in love with the same man. The younger one disappears so that the older one gets the man. And then when she comes back, there's another guy for her. It's right there. Like,
I'm going to go back to the presentation. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt on that. But I think you just hit something there also, that maybe it's the pacing, the slowness of it, and it's meant to be kind of exaggerated when you read it, where maybe current writing is designed for, you know, let's get you in the story and get you moving. and this is just from a more a leisurely and playful time. And this is the sitcom of its day, maybe.
I think that that is absolutely the case. And I think that just like Shakespeare, this was made to be performed, not read. I know Dickens published this as a book to be read, but I think the joy of it would be in seeing the performance of this work.
And with Snitchey and Craggs, you do have, again, a lot of humor and commentary. Like, nothing really happens with Snitchey and Craggs plot-wise, but they are the ones who make the commentary, and their wives are the ones who make the commentary on marriage. And so in this part of the 19th century, early 19th century, this is when we start to get the idea of opposite sex. Instead of men are the superior sex and women are the inferior sex, here we get the idea that, like, actually men and women both have things to offer. They're just different, not different, opposite things, coming back to dualities, right? And so it's interesting how they discuss marriage. And when Mr. Snitchey tells Mrs. Snitchey, oh, you're a companion to me. She says, no, no, I'm not, said Mrs. Snitchey with a majestic smile. I know my station. Will you look at your chosen companion, Mr. Snitchey, at your referee, at the keeper of your secrets, at the man you trust, at your other self, in short? So she's saying, I'm not a companion to you. Craggs is your companion. You are a man who lives for his work and his partnership in the law firm, not at all for his family. And she's not even upset about it. She's just noting a fact of what marriage means to them.
That notion of marriage and partnership is on display here, especially when we get to my favorite character of this whole story, Clemency Newcome, who is just a well-written, fun, entertaining character. Her elbows are always damaged. She's always been running them into something, and she's always rubbing her elbows. The word elbow appears in this story like 20 times, because this character is interesting and fun, and yes, there is a marriage that happens very quickly in this story between Clemency and Little Britain, Mr. Britain, who is sometimes called Little Britain, quote, to distinguish him from great.
Yeah, we wouldn't want her to make that mistake. another playful play with words.
This is a playful sitcom of a story, and as somebody who enjoys sitcoms, I enjoy this playful story.
In this marriage too, we get a certain critique of the institution of marriage, right? So they have this, they run this inn together, and Britain doesn't really understand how important Clemency is to him. So he doesn't fully acknowledge or even, I think, internalize the value of his wife. Here's a quote. Though the host of the Nutmeg Grater had a lively regard for his good wife, it was of the old patronizing kind, and she amused him mightily. Nothing would have astonished him so much as to have known for certain from any third party that it was she who managed the whole house and made him, by her plain, straightforward thrift, good humor, honesty, and industry, a thriving man. So easy it is in any degree of life, as the world very often finds it, to take those cheerful natures that never assert their merit at their own modest valuation, and to conceive a flippant liking of people for their outward oddities and eccentricities, whose innate worth, if we look so far, might make us blush in the comparison. So it starts out this, that was only two sentences, guys. But the first sentence,
oh my God,
is about Britain's inability to see his wife's worth. And then the narrator turns it to the audience. You guys, we all do this a little bit. We take for granted some of the people who are most valuable to ourselves. And if we really looked at some people who are self-effacing, although I wouldn't really call Clementine self-effacing, but she has a modest valuation, apparently, of her own gifts. If we take that for granted, then we're actually making ourselves sort of sad by comparison.
This is a great relationship. This is so similar to my wife and I. We are so much, she is the better half of me in so many ways. And I see how these two characters work so well together. And it's fun to imagine that Mr. Britton doesn't understand. I love this quote too. Mr. Britton's better half seemed to be by so very much his better half that his own moiety of himself was utterly cast away and helpless without her. He doesn't necessarily know how much she is his better half, that she keeps everything in its place and does all of the work around the inn, but they have a great relationship.
And I love that he uses the French there, his own moitié of himself. It's his, because moitié is half in French. And I hadn't even paused on this. And you kind of forget that, like, educated Victorian gentlemen spoke many languages, and he just throws that in there with no regard for people who might not have any idea what he's talking about. And so he's just like using another word for half. Just use the French.
Thank you for pointing out how I didn't understand the French, even though my wife teaches French. No, it's fine, Pam. My better half would have known that word just fine, Pam. I get you. Fine, I got you.
Stop it.
My ignorance is well noted, so let's a non-English major.
We get to the philosophy of these stories. There's so many interesting moments in this where we hear the voice of Charles Dickens telling us all about the philosophy of things. Clemency's philosophy is that of the thimble and the nut grater. We have not read Terry Pratchett in this book club, but Clemency Newcome is a Terry Pratchett style character. There are so many wonderful things written here about how she views life, and she views life from what we might call matchbook philosophy. The thimble has the words forget and forgive inscribed upon it. The nutmeg grater has the words do as you would be done by. That's as simple as philosophy gets, and it works.
It does. I mean, it's as far as this, when I listened to that, I was wondering if that was just going to be the thing for the story. And immediately I thought of a professor over at Loyola University in Chicago who did his dissertation on the Golden Rule. And he thinks there's a real problem with it. And he basically, his solution to the problem with do unto others as you would have done to you was, listen, if I'm willing to poke my eye out, should I be willing to do that to you? And his statement was, treat others as you would consent to be treated in the same situation. So he works out in his dissertation some of the challenges of the Golden Rule.
I wish I could put my finger on it right at this minute, but I just read a book that described the Golden Rule as, instead of do unto others as you would have done unto you, do unto others as they wish to have done unto them. The Silver Rule is do unto others as you wish, because that is very selfish and self-centered, where the relying on what others want is the Golden Rule. I wish I could put my finger on exactly where I heard that, but it stopped me in my tracks when I read it.
Well, not to go down this well of tearing this apart a little bit, but if there's a fiduciary rule for retirement plans, and the trustees have to act as if they were an expert in the information on the decisions they make for the benefit of the plan. I mean, It doesn't just say that, you know, you have to do what you think is best. It is asking you to be an expert in something that you may not be an expert in. There's a lot to glean from, you know, simple philosophy, and criticize too.
And there's more simple philosophy to come in this story. Mm-hmm. Mr. Britton says, I don't care for anything. I don't make out anything. I don't believe anything. And I don't want anything. That is an interesting philosophy of life to get through all of these things around us to focus on what you really want. Mm-hmm. That I love that. Clemency and Benjamin Britton are flirting at one point in the story in such a fun, comical way. Mr. Britton says, I'm not sure that it's what would be considered good philosophy. I've my doubts about that, but it wears well and it saves a quantity of snarling, which the genuine article doesn't always. Here we hear, again, Dickens looking at his philosophy of life and everybody else's philosophy of life and thinking about, well, if we just keep it simple, if we don't focus on things that we can't change, maybe we will be happier. We see a lot of that in A Christmas Carol. The focus on money does not make Scrooge happy. The focus on others is where that story goes.
In my terms, I would say, you know, putting your focus on the things that you value and putting your energy on the things that you value and let go of the things that may not be as important to you, it certainly could help, you know, achieve, you know, a happier life.
This is where the title, The Battle of Life, becomes the philosophy here. The idea of arguing and fighting is not the battle that is being fought. The battle is getting through all of these conditions, getting through all of this stuff, relying on others. Snitchy has a great quote. He says, I don't stand up for life in general, he added, rubbing his hands and chuckling. It's full of folly, full of something worse. Professions of trust and confidence and unselfishness and all that. Bah, bah, bah. We see what they're worth, but you mustn't laugh at life. You've got a game to play, a very serious game indeed. Everybody's playing against you, you know, and you're playing against them. Oh, it's a very interesting thing. There are deep moves upon the board. You must only laugh, Dr. Jeter, when you win, and then not much. That is, I love this philosophy. Everybody's playing against you, and you're playing against them, and it's a game, and you have to be very serious. There are deep moves, and you don't get to laugh until you win, and then not much.
Well, I mean, you can go from there. It's like, he's using it like there is a single board game. Mm-hmm. It's like everybody else playing a whole different board game. And how do you ever determine when, winning or losing? I mean, only that's a subjective way of looking at it. I mean, that's where your answer is. You have to feel like that you are, I don't know, making a difference or whatever that thing is.
And if you win, does everybody else lose?
Yeah, this is not zero-sum world.
Mm-hmm. And when you come back to Grace and Marion, who had those two suitors and disappeared for 6 years, she gives one of the suitors to Grace, which means that Grace wins, but then she also gets the second suitor back. So everybody wins.
Let me get the tissue out. I got it right there. I think that was a tear.
I don't think this is sad or touching. I disagree with you. I think this is a sitcom. I think this is a character-driven, not great narrative. And I can see how this one was lost to time compared to the great narrative that is A Christmas Carol.
And don't forget the cricket. Don't forget the cricket on.
Ah, boy.
Oh, once again, another tissue right there for that one.
I think that one was not a great narrative and it had terrible characters. I think that was my least favorite of these stories so far.
Wow.
But let's go to the end, which I think really relates to this question of games and also of metafiction, stories about stories. So interestingly, this ends with time as capital T time, a character. Time, from whom I had the latter portion of this story, and with whom I have the pleasure of a personal acquaintance of some 35 years' duration, informed me, leaning easily upon his scythe, that Michael Warden never went away again, and never sold his house, but opened it afresh, maintained a golden mean of hospitality, and had a wife, the pride and honor of that countryside, whose name was Marion. End of first sentence. But as I have observed that time confuses facts occasionally, I hardly know what weight to give to his authority. The end. Okay, that is such a weird ending, right? Because suddenly the narrator's like, hey, friends, I'm a 35-year-old. I've known time for 35 years. And here's what time is the one who told me this story. I didn't just make it up. Who told me the end of the story? Told me that Michael Warden did come back, that he was a changed man, that he and Marion were happily ever after. He says in this long sentence, and then he's like, but who knows if you can really trust time? I'm not even sure if the story is true, specifically the ending, the second part. So it's super interesting, right? That, Steve, you're taking this as a sitcom that's, you know, just such a pleasant little tale about these characters. And I'm like, I'm not sure, buddy. I feel like the ending really suggests that, like, this is one of the stories you can tell. You can tell the story that when you do send young men to war to die for their country and a cause that they don't even understand, you get this really fecund and wonderful happy ending for other characters. But that might or might not be true. Cheers, Merry Christmas would be a more cynical way to read the story.
That's like very cynical. That is very cynical, Professor. Sheesh. You've been talking to Chip too much.
Well, I mean, there's the lyrics to, I think it was a band, and the band played Waltzing Matilda, where it is a story about an Australian person pulled off his walkabout, thrown into war, and came back and basically is asking, they play Waltzing Matilda as they leave for war. They play Waltzing Matilda as they come back for war. They play Waltzing Matilda during the parades. And the entire song is basically where the person singing it's just asking, you know, what was it all for? Mm-hmm. And how his life was changed. So, boy, it sounds like maybe that's the sentiment here. Or I'm going to throw this out there. The ending could be that it had to get to the printers on this day. And
Chip, it's not always about it had to get to the printers. Yes, you're right. Pam did some research and found evidence that this was a struggle for Dickens to write this story. So you might be right this one time. One time! Merry Christmas.
There we go. Well, I got an edge here.
So Chip's, you know, look at material culture did almost prevent me from doing my super dark reading. So you were almost saved, Steve. But I am going to come back to this, that there is a way to read this as suggesting that in the battle of life, it's really fairy tales. And this is subtitled A Fairy Tale, The Battle of Life, A Fairy Tale. It is just fairy tales. It is stories. It is narratives with happy endings that make us feel like it's worthwhile. Hmm. And there's something about that that's so nice. Like, wow, the power of literature makes us feel it's worthwhile. But there's something really dark too. Like, it's just an illusion, friends. It's just a game. Cheers.
Merry Christmas. Enjoy. Enjoy your folly.
100 years from now, no one will remember your battle. You're the hero that you are today. You were forgotten.
We're all stories in the end. Make it a good one. Doctor Who.
Good place to end. I like that.
So,
Merry Christmas, everyone.
God bless us, everyone. So we have a couple more of these stories coming up. Next week, we've got The Chimes, which is Dickens' New Year's story. Kind of on the nose that we're talking about a New Year's story next week, huh?
Well.
I say next year. We do some sort of serial killer thing in December to celebrate the holiday much more cheerfully than we did this year.
Oh, please. Please. Let it be a good narrative.
All right. Tell us about The Chimes. Tell us about New Year's Day 2021. We can't wait.
So the good news is that next week we are going to have our guest that we usually have one time during each of our conversations. And our guest next week is currently playing Charles Dickens and narrating The Chimes on stage in Chicago. And we have the ability to see it because of COVID. We can't go see stage work right now, but we can download a online edition of this performance. His name is Nick Sandys, and he is playing Charles Dickens at the Remy Bumpo Theater. You can go to remybumpo.org, and we'll put that in the show notes, to see his rendition of The Chimes. And we'll get to talk to him about that next week. So your assignment is to either see this wonderful performance or to read The Chimes by Charles Dickens.
I'm very excited.
It's going to be really fun, especially how much we've talked about Dickens actually narrating these tales. I love it.
I'm very excited. This is wonderful.
I hope that this will really enliven this reading of these stories, because I think, again, the idea of performance, the Shakespearean quality of this story in particular, and hopefully going forward into The Chimes, is to see it performed, not to be read on the page, because yes, there's some very long sentences. I don't know, Chip. I think we have enough information to survive another week. What do you think?
Only if we can come back next week.
What do you think, Pam?
I'm in.
Yeah. let's finish up 2020. Let's stick a fork in it next week. How about that? We would love to hear from you. Are you enjoying these stories? Are you not enjoying these stories? Are they lost to history? We would love to hear from you. Give us a call or a text. Our phone number is 805-410-4867. Send us an email, sandwiches@irregularhours@gmail.com. Go to our website, sandwiches@irregularhours.com. Find us on Twitter and Instagram and Facebook. Find our podcasts on Apple and Spotify and YouTube. I want to thank you again for listening to Sandwiches at Irregular Hours. I'm Steve Fodor.
I'm Little Tim Hessenflow, not to be confused with Tiny Tim.
And I'm Pat Fedora.
I'm not only deep in debt, but I'm deep in love.